Poetry in Maine. Maine is clearly fertile ground for poetry. From Edna St. Vincent Millay to Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, the words of Maine poets have long resonated around the world and through history. And it's still the case. Maine is home to many notable poets. A few of them have new books out that are receiving accolades. I'm Jennifer Rooks. It's National Poetry Month, so we turn to Richard Blanco, Betsy Scholl, and Gibson Faye LeBlanc to talk about why poetry still resonates in today's world. Richard Blanco's new book of poems, How to Love a Country, and Betsy Scholl's collection, House of Sparrows, were both just released. What are your thoughts about poetry? Do you have a favorite poet? Do you write poetry? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It's National Poetry Month, and we are fortunate here in Maine to have an abundance of prominent poets whose work is varied and rich. We will talk with some of them today about the relevance of poetry in today's world and how to keep poetry alive for future generations. Joining me in the studio, Betsy Scholl. She's former Maine Poet Laureate and author of 9 poetry collections. Her latest collection was just released. It is called House of Sparrows, New and Selected Poems. Richard Blanco is here. He's a poet, memoirist, public speaker, educator, and advocate, and he was the presidential inaugural poet for President Obama. His new collection, How to Love a Country, was just released. And Gibson Faye LeBlanc is a former Portland Poet Laureate, writer, and teacher. He is Associate Director of the Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have questions for our poets? Do you write poetry or enjoy reading it? Why do you think poetry matters in our world today? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome back to all three of you. What a fantastic Friday for me here at Maine Calling. Richard Blanco, I'll start with you. Why do you write poetry?
Well, there's several reasons, but I think the first answer that comes to mind is that every time I write a poem, I feel I've learned something new about myself, about the world, about someone in my life, about a memory. So it's that kind of investigation that brings me to the page over and over again, to not just let life happen to me, but let's sort of really look into what's going on in my life. And that, of course, takes many different dimensions. So that's what keeps me addicted to coming to the page, always that discovery, that sense of learning something new.
Addicted to coming to the page. Betsy, what about you? Why do you write poetry?
I think human beings are makers in general. We make with our hands, we make with our bodies, we make with language. And for me, I was a stutterer, and so writing became a way to get the inside out. And so I think that was a big piece of it for me. And then I just love the idea of starting with something. Like Richard said, not knowing where it's going to go, but to know if you stay with this body of language, you will be led to a new discovery.
I have to tell our listeners, everybody is nodding. As Richard spoke and as Betsy spoke, everybody's agreeing. And what about you,
yeah,
Gibson?
Because they said it so well. I would agree with both Richard and Betsy. For me, it's about paying attention, and I pay better attention to myself, to the world, to the people around me when I'm writing poems, because I discover things in those poems that I didn't realize I knew. And I try to, and the act of putting them into language is the act of discovering them and sort of searing them into memory or searing them into the body in a different way.
Yeah, and it occurs to me also then to share them, because that's actually part of our motivation, if I may speak here, right? It's like, here it is, and then we give it to the world, right? That hopefully they also share in that discovery.
It's interesting for you three, it's sharing, but there are others out there who write and don't share, right?
Right.
Somebody wise said that when you're alone in the room, you're never alone because you're with the language, and that the language, in a way, co-writes the poem. It's old. It's got a long history. It listens to itself. And for some people, It's not about sharing. It's about discovering their inner world. Mm. And maybe the way somebody might pray and never tell anybody.
So, Gibson, is there something special in Maine? Is there a reason we have so many fantastic poets in Maine and have throughout history?
It's a great question because there are so many and they're multiplying daily. I was thinking before I came over here, who are all these, you know, thinking of all the different poets and all the different pockets of the state. I've been fortunate enough the last couple of years to do the Deep Water column in the Maine Sunday Telegram. And we feature poets from all over the state, and I'm always finding new ones. And it's pretty amazing. I mean, I think it has something to do with the quality of life here, you know, the way that one can put together a living in lots of different ways. And, you know, just and the connection with the natural world certainly is a part of how we live here in Maine. And I think that's a part of poetry, too.
Richard, you've lived a lot of places. Do you write differently here than you do when you live in when you're in Miami?
I have to agree that the nature is a big part, and that was part of my move that to Maine, which is now over 10 years. I can't believe it's been that long. The presence of nature is very powerful and sort of grounds us in a way that's really wonderful for writers, for all artists, really. But also, I'm feeling like part of what I love about Maine in general is that it's still a work in progress. It's something that where you can invent, like you're saying, carve out different ways of making a living. And that sort of spirit, I think, is generates creativity. It's sort of nothing is set in stone. You know, so much of Maine is still sort of just happening, right? And evolving and changing and yet rooted in tradition as well. So there's a baseline, but then there's a sense of I don't know, I always say there's this sense of pioneer spirit here in a way still.
You know, I also think that to be a writer, you need a certain amount of solitude. And Maine gives you a little more space than a crowded city. And you can have a community of people, but they might be three towns away. Mm-hmm. So you have a little more space to be yourself.
Yeah,
I can see that. You know, both of your books, both of you have brand new, really, really fine collections out. And congratulations. And Richard, maybe yours a little more obviously so, but Betsy, yours as well. Both are very, very much speak to the times and the world we're living in. And so I want to talk about that, about poetry's role in this divisive world. And Richard, your book, How to Love a Country, I mean, tackles very specific issues, very head on. Why did you decide to write about that as opposed to your backyard and the eagle that's decided to build a nest?
There's some of that in there. But I'd like to say first that, you know, just almost I always like to say that just the mere act of picking up a pen is in a way a political act in the sense that we're not letting life we're not just accepting the status quo in our lives or in our world around us. And so just the mere act of being an artist is in some ways a political act. This book, this collection really came about as a natural sort of organic progression of my role as presidential inaugural poet, where I suddenly had to
You say that really quickly, yeah. Presidential inaugural
well,
poet.
The acronym is PIP, so that's easier. You know, I think all of us here would agree that some things just happen organically. This wasn't like I set out to write this book about all these sociopolitical issues, but in the past 5 years, between just experiencing that public role and then just being in touch with the public in such a grand scale and then asked to write poems for, well, Boston Strong, all these other occasional poems, Freedom to Marry, organizations that approached me sort of just gave me a whole new aesthetic, a whole new way to approach a poem. And it doesn't mean I'll write like that for the rest. Maybe the next book will be much more autobiographical. Who knows? But it wasn't like I timed it. It just was a natural progression. And then, of course, after the 2016 election, so many things have sort of come to surface that the book makes even more sense. But I think they were always sort of seething underneath there. But it's kind of my work has always been about questioning home and place and identity in this country. And that was mostly through an autobiographical lens. But I feel this is the same thing thematically, but it just opening up to not just what, you know, not just what that means to me, but to us as a nation. Right? How do we identify and how do we call this home?
Mm. And Betsy, I'm thinking of the poem that you wrote. Clearly, you or the protagonist was volunteering at the Preble Street Soup Kitchen or another soup kitchen when you wrote that.
Yes, I did that for about 25 years. One of the things I think that always I come back to is wanting to make visible lives of people who in our culture tend to fall through the cracks. And, I was married to somebody who was a community organizer, then a probation officer, then a family therapist. So falling through the cracks has been a part of our lives and for a long time. And just wanting to honor those who are not naturally seen on the shiny, happy commercials in our world.
Gibson, what are your thoughts about the relevance of poetry in today's world in this 24/7, 24/7 even seems like an understatement, where we are just bombarded with information, we're bombarded with divisiveness and rudeness and callous and crass language.
Yeah, and poetry asks us to slow down. You know, you can't fully appreciate a poem, you know, even just reading a poem, reading it out loud or reading it to yourself. Slows you down. It does something to you, to your body. That I think is why many people these days are reaching for poems.
Are we seeing an increase in sales of books of poetry and people who are reading poetry? Betsy, you're nodding. Yes.
Yeah, I think so. I think bookstore sales are up, and I think people just paying attention to all the venues in which poetry occurs.
Mm-hmm. There was actually something that came out. I think I remember. I don't know if it was the NEH or the NEA that actually quantified that there was a spike in poetry.
Yeah.
I don't remember exactly.
NEA, and there were more people than ever reading poetry, or at least saying they're reading poetry, which is in my book, great. You know,
good enough.
Yeah.
We're not going to question it. Okay, so on that note, I asked all of you if you would be willing to read a poem on today's program. Anybody want to go first? Betsy, you get called on.
I did not nod, but I will go.
Well, nobody nodded, so you're sitting directly in front of me.
So this is the shortest poem in my book, I think, and it's called To a Bat Fallen in the Street. Crumpled carbon paper, I thought. Then you moved, humped yourself up and collapsed, using your wings like crutches, straining to inch off the street onto somebody's lawn as if you knew the difference. I bent close enough to see your small cat ears, gargoyle shape, but couldn't bring myself to touch, to help, as if I were what you were made to scare off. Terrible, your struggle to cross. I cringed, wanting a door to shut, wanting to jog off like easy belief, thinking the stars are pure light, not firestorms raging. But there you were, a glimpse of God nobody wants, broken body, dark night with shattered doors, and what sonar beyond my ears still singing.
Thank you. Wow, I love hearing it. I had read that on the page this morning, but it's different now. Thank you. Richard?
Sure, I was going to go last, but just because as a Cuban, I'm not, brevity is not
well,
the
width
of my
Gibson,
soul.
Well, that's you can go last, Richard.
In case we run out of time, I want to make sure.
I'm happy to. I've got a short one, too. This is just a 12-line poem that I wrote for my mom. She had a struggle with cancer a year or two ago and is doing fine now. But she's this, I was thinking about her. She's a beautiful lady and lost all her hair, lost her eyebrows, and just was thinking about that and wrote this little poem. Mother, no matter hair, no matter eyebrows, you are now still the woman who taught me how to smile. I remember the day you came home early from work with a box, the contents of your desk, because you weren't the one sleeping with the boss. And you, single mom with three kids, rent late, refrigerator empty, you let the box down and showed your beautiful teeth.
Mm. Thank you. Mm. Okay, it's really your turn now. Okay. Oh, we do have time. Okay, we are still in the first half hour, Richard.
We've been well. So we're doing great. So this is one of the poems from the new book. And I was thinking here, a weaving of the autobiographical, the political, and whatnot. But thinking about the kind of innocent patriotism that I remember as a kid, before we learn about party affiliations, before all that, and just that sense of belonging, that innocent sense of belonging to a country, and this, well, in our sense, in this sense, America, and those ideals that we were taught as kids. And it's all for me wrapped up in the song "America the Beautiful." So I'm going to sing a little bit, horribly so, but America the Beautiful, again, how I sang, oh, beautiful, like a psalm at church with my mother, her Cuban accent scaling up every word, oh, beautiful, yet in perfect pitch, delicate and tuned to the radiant beams of stained glass light. How she taught me to fix my eyes on the crucifix as we sang our thanks to our Savior for this country that saved us. Our voices, hymns as passionate as the organ, piping toward the very heavens. How I sang, for spacious skies, closer to the skies while perched on my father's sunbeat shoulders, towering above our first 4th of July parade. How the timber through our bodies mingled, breathing, singing as one with the brass notes of the marching band, playing the only song he ever learned in English. How I dared to sing it at assembly with my teenage voice cracking for amber waves of grain that I'd never seen, nor the purple mountains' majesties, but could imagine them in each verse rising from my gut, every exclamation of praise I belted out until my throat hurt, America, and again, America. How I began to read Nietzsche and doubt God, but still wish for God to shed his grace on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood. How I still want to sing, despite all the truth of our wars and our gunshots ringing louder than our school bells, our politicians smiling lies at the mic, the deadlock of our divided voices shouting over each other instead of singing together. How I want to sing again, beautiful or not, just to be harmony, from sea to shining sea, with the only country I know enough to know how to sing for.
Thank you, Richard Blanco. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Diversions Puzzles and Games, committed to offering fun, social, and technology-free ways to connect at Hannaford Plaza by Maine Mall and in downtown Portsmouth.
The system for funding public education pits rich school districts against poorer ones and can give rich philanthropists outsized influence.
It only contributes sort of greater volatility to public systems.
I've often wondered if people from some of these wealthier communities, if they would put up with this.
On Next from the New England News Collaborative, we'll look at school funding around our region. Plus, we'll explore food insecurity for Vermont's farm workers. Please join us.
That's coming up today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
I'm Brian Lehrer from WNYC. I'm from New York, a state that's considering having legal weed.
I'm Anne-Marie Awad from Colorado Public Radio. I'm from a state that already has legal weed.
Join both of us for a public radio special event as we discuss the changing legal, political, and cultural landscape around cannabis.
Tune in and call in to Ask a Legal State, a national conversation about pot.
You can listen to that tomorrow from noon to 3 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are talking about the role of poetry. Joining me, Richard Blanco, presidential inaugural poet, speaker, educator, advocate. He has a new poetry collection out titled How to Love a Country. Gibson Fay LeBlanc is former Portland Poet Laureate, writer and teacher, and he's with the Maine Writer and Publishers Alliance. And Betsy Scholl is former Maine Poet Laureate. Her latest collection is House of Sparrows, New and Selected Poems, also just out this year. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is Richard Forrester. He's a poet whose eighth book, Boy on a Doorstep, New and Selected Poems, has just been published. Thanks for calling in, Richard.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you, Jennifer, for including me in the program.
Congratulations on your new book. I understand this collection spans 40 years of your poetry. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yes, 40 years. The oldest poem in there dates from about 1979. My first book came out in 1992 when I was in my 40s. But I've been writing a long, long while, and it covers childhood, marriage, my loves, loss of loves, nature, living in Maine, and wanting to always be near the ocean.
How has your relationship with poetry and your thoughts on the role of poetry, how have they changed in that 40 years?
They have evolved. Initially, I was very concerned with my dysfunctional family, being the son of German immigrants, a divorce. But then I've moved on after moving to Maine in 1986, being closer to nature, being closer to the ocean, my daily life. I work at home, so my daily life has always informed my poetry.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling us and joining this conversation. Richard Forrester, a poet with a newly published collection titled Boy on a Doorstep. So another person talking about how nature mm-hmm. has informed his work.
May I mention that Richard is going to be reading at the Portland Public Library tomorrow at 2, along with Jeffrey Thompson and Elizabeth Tibbetts.
Thank you. I didn't know
that. Oh, and me. Gibson's pointing at me. Like.
You know, I will say that I don't think I'm going to take a class in self-promotion from poets.
No, work.
Calling in now, Julia Bousma. She's a poet, librarian, farmer, and editor. Her new book is entitled Midden. Thanks for joining us, Julia.
Hi, Jennifer. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Congratulations on your new book and on receiving the Poets Out Loud Prize for it. Can you describe your book to us? It is somewhat unconventional.
Yeah, so my book is about the Malaga Island eviction, which for listeners who don't know, in 1912, the state of Maine forcibly evicted an interracial community of about 47 people from Malaga Island, which is off the coast of Phippsburg. They sent 9 people, including one whole family, to the Maine School for the Feeble-Minded. They told people to take their homes down or they would be burned. So people took their houses down themselves because they needed material to rebuild. And then they had a hard time finding anywhere they were welcome. They also took down a school off of the island, and they dug up 17 graves that were combined into 5 caskets and reburied unmarked at the Maine School for the Feeble-Minded. So it was a really intentional erasure, and what followed was, you know, about 100 years of silence, more or less.
How did you decide to write about that, a book of poetry?
I wanted to try to write into that silence. The poet Aracelis Gourmet says that a poem's job is to have a conversation with silence. Although I didn't know that. I mean, she didn't tell me that until I was already well underway. But, you know, I think that silence was something that really spoke to me. As someone with Jewish ancestry, I recognized certain patterns of erasure in my own family history. And I also have a very, very deep connection to the land that I live on, which is 85 acres in the woods in Maine. I mean, in Western Maine, I'm sorry, obviously in Maine, that on Malay Hill in New Portland, and actually used to be a farm that was settled by Edna St. Vincent Millay's paternal great-grandparents. And Edna St. Vincent Millay's paternal great-grandmother is buried on my property.
Well,
So, but I have this really deep connection to my land, and I was thinking about what it would be like to be removed from my land. So that was one of the lenses in. But it was just a story that needed to be told, and poetry provides a form that can tell it in a way that other forms can't necessarily, which is to really be able to hold everything that's painful and everything that's beautiful together at the same time.
Gibson.
I don't know. Yeah. That makes any.
Julia, that makes total sense. This is Gibson.
Hi, Gibson.
I just wanted to add, too, that Julia's first book, Work by Bloodlight, won a Maine Literary Award last year. So she's had two wonderful books in the last couple of years. And that those poems are that come out of that connection with the land that she's speaking of. And so there's these two wonderful Maine books that she's, you know, carved out of this place, which is great.
Oh, well, Julia, thanks so much for calling in. That's Julia Bousma, a poet, editor, farmer, and librarian whose new book is called Midden. I'm going to start here with a message from Kathy, and you guys are going to love this. Why do poems no longer rhyme?
Well, you know, I might start to say in English, in the beginning, poems didn't rhyme. English, in fact, is a rhyme-poor language compared to, say, Italian. And the Anglo-Saxon poets didn't rhyme. They used alliteration and things like that. You know, in summer season, when soft was the sun, I shaped me into shrouds as if I a shepherd were. There's a lot of music in that, but it's
but
not.
But it doesn't rhyme.
It's not in rhyme.
It's
yeah,
not in rhyme.
Yeah,
right.
And that's where English begins.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think there's poems still rhyme. It's just not end rhyme. And I think people need to sort of realize that we have a lot of internal rhyme and sounds going on all the time that are still give us the same kind of pleasure. But it's really, I mean, it's really just like everything else. It's an evolution of an art. We don't paint the same way. We don't take photographs the same way. We don't dance the same way. So it's just a natural evolution of the art. And really rhyme is really a sound device for memory when there were no books. Mm-hmm. And so it's part of the oral tradition that's just evolved. But right. There's still beauty. I mean, that's still a very big part of poetry. It's just become less of a standard convention, but it's still there. And there's still a lot of poets writing, neo-traditionalists that write, that still work. Try to find those last few rhymes remaining in English, at least end rhymes, right?
Well, you know, and you're talking, Richard, about all the different things that go on within a poem, and as well, you, Betsy. I want to know from all of you, how do you know when a poem is finished?
Oh, that is the hardest question, I think.
When your friends tell you.
Yeah, exactly.
When your publisher tells you.
I love the story about Robert Frost's famous poem, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. You know, whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. That poem, which most people have heard.
And has end rhyme.
And has plenty of end rhyme.
End rhyme, yes.
And even that poem, which has such a clear rhythm and rhyme pattern, he didn't know how to end that poem. He didn't know what the second to last line of the poem was going to be. He knew the last line was, and miles to go before I sleep. He didn't know what the second to last line was. It's repeated in the poem in the end, but it took him 10 years to figure that out. He had it in a drawer. He would pull it out and try different things. Nope, not good enough. Put it back. You know, so 10 years of fiddling with that.
Wow, Betsy, you ever had 10 years on a poem?
Yes, I did. I had a poem where I had half of the poem, but something else had to happen for the poem to click, and it turned out it had to be that I had to get sick in bed for a week and read all the letters of Keats and his obsession with beauty, and that in connection to a car crash I had suddenly put it all together. But that took 8 years.
What about you? What's your record?
Poems always, I haven't really kept track, but certainly there's poems that never made it in my first book of poetry that made it into my third. And I think it's really just an emotional, psychological process. So I wouldn't say that I think a poem is ever done, but there is a moment where you let it go. And speaking about where the reasons we write usually begin in a very sort of, as I always say, like writing a poem is the dumbest, most arrogant, self-centered thing you could do, because it has to begin in that angst of like your own world. And it's slowly the art sort of lets you, the language and what lets you find that discovery. And there's a moment where there's a letting go, where the poem starts telling you what to do or what not to do, or the poem says, screw you, or I'm not ready yet. But I would say that is, for me, sort of when I know it's not done, but there's a letting go that gives me a sense of patience and saying, well, I might find that second to last line, but I can put it away. Mm-hmm. And so that's another kind of part of the process. And then some of those 5-minute poems that come to you because you're working on the 10-year poem, the 5-minute poem, but you can't have it both ways.
But your subconscious has been working on that 5-minute poem.
Yeah, I think when a poem clicks is when that subconscious finds, when the conscious mind finds language for the subconscious, when they sort of meet and there's a consciousness that happens that sort of wells up from all those experiences and imprints. And each poem, in a way, is very different. I mean, each poem has its own genesis, its own journey.
Gibson, as Associate Director of Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance, you know pretty much most of the writers in Maine. Are poets different than other writers?
For sure. I mean, poets approach language differently. I think writers across genres you usually get along just fine. You know, there's a lot of common, you know, fellow feeling among writers in Maine. It's a small community in many ways. Many people know each other. But poets, we're dealing with such small pieces of language, you know, and we're, you know, you present a piece of writing to, you know, 3 writers, 1 nonfiction, 1 fiction, 1 poet. You know, the nonfiction writer is talking about the research that went into that and all these connections to societal issues, and the fiction writer is talking about the arc of the passage and how the character, the speaker, is getting developed. And the poet is like, look at that sentence, that one sentence in the middle. That's an amazing sentence.
We'll go to Margie calling from Jonesboro. Hi, Margie.
Hi. Well, here's my poem, Jennifer Rooks of NPR. Her voice is a pleasant star. All topics, happy or sad, they may be good or bad, with comments from all. Keep it up. Laugh. Have a ball. Happy Easter, everyone. Be sure to have some fun. And I got a lot of poems, too.
Margie, thank you. You've made me blush, I think. Thank you. We'll move on to Bear calling from Wells. Hi, Bear. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. How are you doing?
Oh, wonderful.
And to all the poets and writers, thank you very much for being there. I just have a couple of comments. I'm relatively new to Maine. I've moved here 2 years ago from Texas. And, first let me go to the, I think you, Richard, said something about the unconscious. And I think that's, for me as a poet, if I don't do my own personal work, you know, to look at my unconscious, when I do it, I find things flowing, and you know, I am able to see more things metaphorically, all of that. So I just think that's a very key aspect to our creativity, is somehow, you know, being able to see what's there and then harness it, and then, you know, I think it's a powerful political resistance, which is what I also feel poetry is about. You know, especially in the society. So I wanted to just make that comment. The other comment is, are there organizations? I've had I suppose like everybody else, I've had a hard time getting published. And it's almost like I feel like, well, who do you have to know in this business to get a foot in the door? But anyway, that's what I'm looking for. I'm trying to find a way. I've got a novel. It's just I wrote and poetry and stuff.
Well, Bear, have called the right program. I know who you can talk to.
Yeah. Bear, Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance is definitely an organization you should check out if you haven't already. We have workshops and conferences happening all over the state, including a lot of poetry, novel stuff, fiction stuff, nonfiction, you name it. We're doing it. I think we had some close to 80 workshops and conferences across the state in the last year. So, you know, there's tons of stuff out there. Great poets that you can work with who will help you, you know, come up with ideas for your own work.
And is the website mwpa.org?
It's mainwriters.org.
Ooh, mainwriters.org. My memory was failing me. Thank you, Bear, for your call. We'll move to Jason, who is calling from Freeport. Hi, Jason. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing? I just wanted to give a call. I publish an arts magazine in the area called Northern Journeys, and two of your poets there today were both a part of that from the start. I mean, they both sent me a poem in, and it's been very beneficial to keeping that going. I'm actually just pulled over. I've got a truck full of my next magazine that has Gary Lawless. I think some of you might know him, a poet from Brunswick. But I just wanted to call and say thank you very much for, you know, helping out with that magazine. And also that I'll see you Saturday if you're going to be at the Portland Library.
Yes. Well, I am with Richard Foster, Elizabeth Tibbetts, and Jeffrey Thompson. Then Richard is at Space beginning at 5.
At 5.
But that's sold out, right?
I think so, yeah.
It is. There might be a scalper around.
Right, or cancellations. There's always cancellations.
Oh, boy. Well, Jason, thank you. Whose poems, who's in this room, have you published?
Portland and Richard Blanco. Mm-hmm. Richard Blanco was in our second one. I think it was Crayons for Elena.
Oh, yeah.
And it was sort of an interesting situation because we thought Mr. Blanco was going to be the next poet laureate of Maine. And turns out that I guess you don't live here full time, so that couldn't happen, or that we just got mixed up from the poet laureate of Maine at the time. But we had sent in to ask you for a poem, and then even though, you know, that wasn't the case, that you were nice enough to send us a poem. Yeah.
Jason, we didn't have you potted up, but who else has been in your, other than Richard?
The gentleman you have there is the poet laureate of Maine. He has three names that I can't, you know, I don't
Gibson Fay LeBlanc?
Right now. Yes, of course, yes. And
So much for calling, and good luck with your magazine, Northern Journeys. We do have to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do South Street Linen, dedicated to creating stylish, all-season linen clothing for women made in Maine. SouthStreetLinen.com. And Green Hut Galleries, with Maine, the Painted State, a biennial invitational exhibition through April 27th. GreenHutGalleries.com.
The Mueller Report is the end of a chapter, but the next one, well, it's just beginning.
We are the lawmaking branch of government, and we are the ones who will decide whether there were high crimes and misdemeanors committed by this president.
Do voters, though, have an appetite for more?
You do see a majority of Americans saying, no, let's move on to something else.
That's next time on The Takeaways, Politics with Amy Walter from WNYC and PRI.
The Takeaway is this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
There was that time that Barbara Streisand invited me over.
Do you want to take a sip of soup?
We talked about childhood, ice cream preferences.
Brazilian coffee.
And what it was like to direct.
You never have to raise your voice because everybody's finally listening.
I'm Alec Baldwin from Barbara Streisand's house. On the next Here's the Thing from WNYC.
That's coming up Sunday evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, all about poetry. Joining us today, three well-known Maine poets, Gibson Fay LeBlanc, Betsy Scholl, and Richard Blanco. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Joining us on the line now, Steve Luttrell. He is former Portland Poet Laureate and the founding editor of the Cafe Review, which is a Portland-based poetry and art journal. Thanks for calling in, Steve. Oh, that's my fault. There. Hi, Steve. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Jennifer, and hi to the panel.
Hey, Steve.
Thanks for celebrating poetry.
So you've just been honored again, for the 30th anniversary of the Cafe Review. Congratulations. This publication you started has been keeping the conversation about poetry alive ever since. Steve, what keeps you going? What keeps you so dedicated to poetry that you've been making this happen for 30 years?
Well, I guess I could say I'm a study in tenacity. I've had a lot of help in the 30 years. It's not anything one could have accomplished solo. As a matter of fact, one of your panelists at one point was our reviews editor briefly, and for which I thank him. And So, yeah, it's been the cumulative effect, I think, of, 14, 15 people that have since become close friends over the years. So, I'm the guy that just kind of kicked the can and other people helped it roll down the hill.
So how would you characterize the poetry scene in Maine today?
Well, let me recoil somewhat from the word scene. It's not one that I... But, you know, the poetry community is very vital, obviously very active. There are two or three readings. Young people are responding to the source of the poem in their own way, you know, generationally. We've been working a lot in the last year or two, last two or three years, actually, with a lot of foreign poets. We were in Iceland last year, and as you know, we were just there shortly before you were there, I think, or after. So we're trying to combine a lot of different tones of voice, not just the wonderful poets of Maine, but, you know, the global village.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us. That's Steve Luttrell, poet and the founding editor of the poetry journal The Cafe Review, which celebrates 30 years. We'll go to Kay, who's calling from Northport. Hi, Kay. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, I just had a question. I've written some poems over maybe 5 or 6 years when I was going through some difficult things. And since then, I just haven't had any poetry coming out of my head. So what do you do to get that inspiration?
Read.
Yeah.
I mean, I think sometimes it just... one of my poetry teachers used to talk about sometimes just there's not any poems for you out there, and that's okay. But also to be constantly reading and paying attention to the world as much as you can, looking at art, going out and experiencing things, taking notes, and just see, you know, that those are the things that I do when nothing's happening. Right. I'm reaching for other poets' work who inspire me.
Right, and you know, I think. For many poets, there are times when you don't write, and Louise Gluck talks about this. It could take her, she might go 5 years and not write. And one of the issues is to not panic, to remind yourself that it will come back and trust, and just try to be alert without worrying about the silence. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I feel the same way, and I think it gets back to this idea of the subconscious. Sometimes the well is emptied, but you have to do something that you also can't sort of just say, okay, I'm not writing, right? So journaling, reading. Right. I'm a binge writer myself, like Louise Glick as well. Like I won't go for years formally writing, not years, but maybe months, or penning a poem here and there, but I don't, and then I just say, okay, it's time to birth a book, and I'll sit down for 3 or 4 months and like it just comes out. But I've trusted the process to realize my subconscious has to catch up. Like it needs to take in. It needs to, but you can't also be passive. You have to be active in other ways. Right. And I think it's what we're all saying.
Right. I mean, I think the metaphor of the ocean's a good one. There are tides. Mm-hmm. And being aware of the tides, and also you do different things. You collect shells when the tide's low.
Right.
I like that. Kay, thank you for your call. We'll move on to Earl, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Earl. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just been listening to the program, and I wanted to mention that the Rotary Club in Bangor picks 2 or 3 weeks in a month, and all of us who want to get up and read a poem. And, so we'll have quite a variety of poems that people will come up with, and it's entertaining and enlightening.
I love that. Thanks for sharing that, Earl.
That's
awesome. I appreciate
it. That's great.
Wonderful.
You know, I think that's part of what we're talking about, like how poets are different, what Gibson was saying. I think for those of us that sort of maybe have trouble thinking about poetry, wrapping our head around poetry or how we're approaching poetry, just think of it, it's so much closer to being to song, right?
Yeah.
Because it's origins.
Yeah.
And we enjoy it in a different way. We create it in a different way. And I just love that idea of just getting up and reading a poem. And yet most Americans will say like, oh, I don't read poetry, but they all have a favorite poem or two that they remember. Mm-hmm. And it's really like song. You don't always need to know the nth degree of what it means, but it lives in your body. And it's communal. That's the other thing. It is really a communal art form. And the poetry reading is like, it's like going to the musical concert, right? Mm-hmm. Like you were saying, Jennifer, earlier, hearing Betsy's poem creates a different experience, right? It's mm-hmm. so much of the DNA of poetry. So I love that. I especially, you know, I one of the things that keeps me going is having that live connection with people. And I got to call the Rotary Club in Bethel and they can go read a few
That's
poems.
Great.
Oh, I bet that would be a sellout crowd.
I was just going to add, too, there's that long tradition of poems being read in Grange Halls throughout Maine.
Mm, yeah.
Wes McNair, when he did his big, you know, Take Heart readings all around the state, you know, was building on that. I mean, it goes way, way back. People, you know, love to just sit around and listen to a poem.
And I love that you mentioned Grange Halls. We're planning a Maine calling program on Grange, the Grange in Maine. So that's in a few weeks. We're going to go to Patricia calling from Arundel. Hi, Patricia. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Well, I want to thank Richard Blanco for the wonderful workshop he gave. I think it was probably 3 years ago at Union Church Speaker Series. And, of course, he's reading. It was just wonderful. And many people in the room writing a poem at the moment. Secondly, I'm a poet, actress, musician, and I'm presenting Emily Dickinson's A Solitude of Space this Sunday, April 28th, with other musicians and a narrator at River Tree Arts. In honor of National Poetry Month, it's really about Emily's struggle to find her voice as a poet and music along with it.
Wonderful. Patricia, I invite you to go on today's Facebook post and add that information to our comments section so others can.
All right. And thank you for this program. I think poetry is alive and well, and it's wonderful that it is.
Thank you. We'll try to squeeze in one more call. We'll go to Nancy from Brook Bluff. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead.
Yes. I find that when I think I've finished a poem and then read it, well, it isn't finished at all. That it has to flow in some way, and then I'm changing it. And it seems much more correct after I read it. I'm alone sort of here in the woods in Rock Bluff, so other people aren't hearing it, so I'm reading it. Do the other poets do this too?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah, rhythm and reading aloud. I mean, you have to hear that thing aloud, and it has to, we've said a couple of times today, it has to live in your body, and so you have to put it out into the air so you can really feel it in that way.
Right. You know, it almost feels to me like sometimes it feels like tuning a piano by mm-hmm. ear. Mm-hmm. You just have to write it and listen and stop and try again. If you change one word, you might change everything. And, you know, it takes a lot of patience and a lot of sort of acute listening to both the tone of the poem and also to the presence of the self. You know, is the self too loud? Does the self need to own something? Does the self need to step back and let something else happen?
That's amazing. I usually use the same analogy of sometimes when I'm writing a poem, I feel like I'm tuning an instrument, and then you hit that chord. The poem's certainly not done, and maybe it's just beginning, but you, when you hear that chord, you're like, you trust it enough to keep on going. Yeah. And certainly reading it out loud, because again, getting back to the music analogy, sort of like writing lyrics but never playing them out loud, right? So you have to see what they feel like in the air, in the room, and again, in your body. So, yeah, definitely. It's funny. Yeah. We use the same exact analogy.
So, Richard, I know you write late at night. So if I drove by your home and looked in the window, you'd be kitchen table reciting to yourself.
Till like 2 or 3 in the morning. Yeah. And getting back to the caller's comment about sometimes you go to bed. I don't know if this happens to you too, but you're like, it's a little late or like whatnot, and you go to bed and like you feel pretty good about the poem, and then in the morning you're like, oh my God, the ugly poetry fairy came and like sprinkled ugly poetry dust over. Yeah. And that's because
things are supposed to be better in the morning, not worse. Oh my gosh, what a delight and what a wonderful Friday. We do end the show a little early on Fridays because we have Poems from Here every Friday on Maine Public Radio. So thank you to our guests here, Betsy Scholl, former Maine Poet Laureate and the author of 9 poetry collections. Her latest, hot off the press, House of Sparrows. And Richard Blanco, presidential inaugural poet, PIP, memoirist, public speaker, educator, and advocate. His new collection, How to Love a Country, is out now. And Gibson Faye LeBlanc,
former Portland Poet Laureate, writer, teacher, associate director of the Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Isaac Merson took your calls. Our theme song was composed by Mike Jandreau. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Public Radio.